This is an ABC podcast.
Heard the buzzing of the honeybees, making honey just for me, and life is all right. I think I landed feeling.
Hello, this is The Money on RN Summer. I'm Richard Adey, and today we're going to talk about poker machines, the pokies. Australia has more of them than anywhere else in the world, 200,000, half of which are in New South Wales. They're in pubs, they're in casinos, but their centre of gravity is the clubs. They're what pays for all those clubs and some feel-good advertising.
And all my troubles seem to fade away.
I was just a young teen and I walked into the club with my boyfriend because he was a little older than me and he enjoyed playing them. And I wanted to spend time with him, so I sat down next to him and started playing.
This is Kate Seselja, founder of the Hope Project.
I put in $20 and won a couple of hundred. And I thought, wow, that was easy, you know, and that was really kind of the beginning of thinking that I was in control of, you know, what I was doing. And I had no idea that they were so intentionally designed to manipulate my brain.
Every year, we lose something between $13.5 billion and $15 billion on the pokies. Francis Markham's a research fellow at the ANU. He says even if you take the smaller of those figures, it's real money.
It's about $725 for each adult in the country. And it's much more than that when you think about the fact that most people don't actually play the pokies. So it's a huge amount by any measure. And I can try and put that in comparison because once the numbers start hitting the billions, I find it hard to get a sense of their magnitude.
Okay.
So $13.5 billion is more than 1% of Australia's GDP. It's about $1.50 for every $100 that any person spends in Australia. And to compare it to some other sort of recreational activity like going to the cinema, it's about 12 times more than the amount we spend on movie tickets each year. In terms of government budgets, it's far more than the government spends on unemployment benefit, for example. So it's a very big number we're talking about.
If you're a pub or a club and you want to buy a machine, it's not that much. Charles Livingston's in the School of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Monash University.
Brand new, the average price of an Aristocrat machine is about $21,000. They vary in price, but $20,000 to $25,000 appears to be the general range for a new one. I've got one in my office, which we bought some years ago for $5,000. It's a second-hand one. I probably got ripped off on that, but anyway. You can buy second-hand ones for a few hundred dollars in some markets. So they cost new, they'll cost $20,000 to $25,000. In New South Wales, they make an average of $65,000 or so a year. In Victoria, they make an average of $100,000 a year once you put them on the floor and turn them on. All you have to do, really, is get them serviced periodically and empty the cash out every night, which is probably not a particularly onerous undertaking.
But who's putting all that money in? Francis Markham.
The best estimates we have in Australia suggest about 20 to 25% of Australians play pokies at least once a year, which tends to be the kind of bar for whether or not we count someone as playing the pokies. And that can be quite a sort of misleading statistic in many ways, because many people might just play the pokies once a year, for example. If you kind of drill down and look at the people who would play pokies in a typical month, it's only about 8% of the adult population. And in this group, there's about 1 in 3 people will really run into significant problems with their gambling. And it's this group, this very small percentage, who incur most of the losses. So at a national level, about 3% of the population contribute 2/3 of all poker machine revenue. And if you narrow down into the kind of 1% of the population who experience the most severe harms from gambling, they're contributing about 40% of all poker machine revenue. So it's fair to say, I think, that the viability of poker machine industry is underwritten by a really small percentage of individuals who are spending very large sums of money.
Kate Seselja has been in that very small group, and it didn't take long to get there.
Within the first month, it was growing up in Sydney, there wasn't really a venue, a nightclub or a club or a pub that didn't have pokies. So once I had discovered that I enjoyed playing them, every single time I was out socialising with my friends or my boyfriends, they were there and I could hear them and I would be drawn to them. And it was just something that, yeah, it just so quickly overwhelmed me.
And how much were you spending each week?
At that time, I was I was a receptionist at an accounting firm, and I was earning $1,200 a month, and that would be gone sometimes on payday.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how were you paying for the rest of your life?
I was living at home still with my mum and dad. So I would borrow off my siblings, I would borrow off my mum and dad, and, you know, I would just try to exist for another month and then hopefully, you know, have a win. And just, yeah, it was just this constant cycle of either, you know, having some money or not having some money. But more often than not, it was not having any money.
Kate Cecilia was a teenager when this started. Laurie Brown was a grown-up.
I probably have been playing the pokies most of my adult life, but they weren't problematic. And then in late 2011-12, I really became addicted to poker machines. And I work in Canberra during the week at the University of Canberra. My partner is a full-time farmer, and I go out to the farm property at the weekends. So in the evenings, I'd ring him up thinking, well, our conversation for the night is finished. I'd then head off to a club about 10 o'clock at night, and I'd stay there till closing. So this was late 2011-2012. And I kept that very secretive. And then I was sprung, if you like, because the bank contacted my partner. And I said, yes, look, I've got an addiction. I've been spending money on poker machines.
So she was caught. She stopped. That should have been it.
And then, and to this day, I don't really know why, I returned in mid-2015. I had relocated and I was admitted to a club, which was 5 minutes from where I lived. And I just went straight back into the old addictive behaviours on Monday, Tuesday, and often Wednesday nights. I'd talk to John in the mid-evening, and then about 10, 10.30, I'd head off to this club and I'd stay there till 4 o'clock in the morning. And very quickly, I lost a significant amount of money.
So how much, when you say a very significant amount, how much are we talking?
Because I only gambled at this one club, I could go right through all my bank statements, and looking at the amount of money I took out for gambling, and a significant amount was actually at the club through their ATMs and FPOS facilities. In the end, it worked out to be $230,000 over a 18-month period.
It's a staggering amount. Kate Cecilia managed to stop. She moved to Canberra, started her life again, got married. 18 months later, she was back on the machines.
It essentially went on then for 12 years of our marriage, just on and off, and just, it was terrible. It was just such a cycle of, I don't know how to deal with this. Then I'd get, you know, try and get help. And back then, you know, help wasn't very helpful. The first time I rang Lifeline, I was just at my wit's end. I woke up at 3 in the morning just in an absolute sweat, thinking I can't live like this anymore. And so I rang Lifeline and I was told, don't wear shoes, because if you wear shoes, you'll be able to get into a venue. And so, you know, if you don't wear shoes, you won't be able to get into a venue, so you won't be able to gamble. And I was like, oh my gosh, is this it? Is this all there is as a solution for this? I remember going up to a bar manager once at a club after I'd put so many thousands in and it hadn't paid one single feature. And I said to him, how do you have this sign saying that it returns, you know, 98% or something? And, you know, I've put this money in and it's come back nothing. And he goes, I don't know what to tell you, lady. You know, I just felt so embarrassed and ashamed and I just hated who I was.
So how much did you lose?
Oh, hundreds of thousands, over 500,000, easy. It was just any money I could get my hands on, I would gamble. And, you know, I'd just be trying to conceal it as best as I could. But
it sounds like an awful dark spiral in which you're full of regret, the machines still call, and you feel so stressed and you play the machines to not feel stressed and then you feel worse again.
Yes, that's exactly right.
So while there's huge profits for the owners of poker machines, there's real costs as well. Charles Livingston.
The Victorian Responsible Gambling Foundation funded a study which was published last year which estimated the social costs of gambling overall at around $6.9 billion a year to Victoria, which is more than four times the amount of revenue the state government gets from taxing all forms of gambling, comes in around $1.6, $1.7 billion a year. And those harms include, obviously, financial catastrophe, which has significant costs associated with it, divorce and separation, you know, breaking up of families, neglect of children, loss of major assets, both for the gambler and their spouses and children and family generally, both mental and physical health problems. There are some links between gambling harm and poor physical health, including heart disease. There are certainly significant links between gambling and mental health problems. You know, the impact on kids is significant. It extends poverty between generations. There's no doubt about that. Children of a gambler are about 10 times more likely to themselves end up in a serious situation with gambling than the general population. So there's that transmission as well. And of course, in extreme cases, there's suicide.
It can also flow on in more kind of directly pernicious ways. So we know, for example, that areas with more poker machines have higher domestic violence rates. And it seems very likely that all of the stress involved in dealing with the fallout from a gambling problem can just exacerbate existing problems and end up with things like heightened interpersonal conflict and even violence.
Now, that there's no causal link that we know of, as far as I know. But those numbers do overlap.
Those numbers do overlap. And once you adjust for all of the regular kind of correlates, it's pretty clear that the rates of family violence are higher in areas with more poker machines.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Aidy. Today, we're looking at poker machines and the people who become addicted to them. But actually, why is that? Why do some people develop such a problem? Natasha Schull's the author of Addiction by Design.
I think that question, why do some certain people become addicted and others don't, is exactly the question that the gambling industry focuses on in its own attention to this problem and where they want us to focus, because they want it to be a question about an individual and what that individual carries inside of them that might predispose them to this behavior. And they might carry it inside them genetically, chemically, or maybe they had a terrible childhood, or it's sort of social, or they were very poor. You know, this kind of question, and what that takes our attention away from is the other side of the relationship that forms between the person and the object of addiction, which in this case happens to be a highly engineered, carefully designed machine. Any good addiction researcher knows from any field of addiction research that addiction is a relationship. And you can't really understand any relationship if you're looking only at one side of it. You just don't get a full picture. Of course, I know some people come into this world more liable to become addicted because of their brain chemistry, because of genetics, what have you, life experiences. But it's also true that some interfaces and interactive technologies come into this world, more liable to addict human beings.
And what those human beings are addicted to is zoning out.
This was actually the most counterintuitive thing that I found in my research, was that these gamblers are not, it's not that they're lacking in probability skills or that they think they're going to win. I mean, yes, there are people out there who think that, but by and large, the real addicts that I spoke to knew very well that they weren't going to win. And what they had figured out through their relationship with this machine is that it afforded them a kind of escape from their lives that they were really desiring. And that point was really driven home to me when I kept hearing over and over again from people, you know, it's really strange, but sometimes when I win a jackpot, I get so frustrated. I feel this horrible sense of tension. I almost get angry. I have to switch to another machine and immediately start playing again. And what I came to realize is that they're not playing to win. They're playing to keep playing.
So what's going on here? Why the appeal? Natasha Shul says there's three parts to it.
One is that the interaction with the machine is solitary. So this is not a situation where you have any sort of social cues for stopping or people who are providing a kind of net so that you don't fall into it because they're interrupting you or you have to wait for them or just basically be in the world with others. It's just you and the machine. So you can go at whatever pace you want. You don't have to really be present. And that's one of the things that irritates people when they win a jackpot is suddenly the machine freezes up. Everybody's looking at them, maybe congratulating them. They're back in the world as a subject, as a self, which is often what they want to get away from. They want to have that liberating sort of merging with the machine, merging with the world, relief of the zone. So solitary, the solitariness of it.
That's just the beginning.
A second aspect would be the speed. You can play up to 1,200 hands or events unfold in an hour. And that is incredibly fast. So I always have to just shake my head and smile to myself when people talk about irresponsible gambling, because responsibility really requires pausing and thinking. And how can you possibly be making decisions, rational decisions, when you're making 1,200 of them in an hour? And it is just experienced as this flow. One press leads into the next press, leads into the next press. And it's very hypnotic. So I would say that solitariness of it, and then the speed of it, and then the continuity, and the fact that there's no natural end point except running out of money. You know, it's sort of uncertainty and then closure, uncertainty and then closure. So there's something about that constant state of uncertainty, and nothing is ever ended and nothing is ever resolved.
Charles Livingston says this has a powerful effect on our brain chemistry.
Now, in more recent times, what we've discovered is the mechanism for this, and it's called the striatal dopamine system. So in everybody's brain, every mammal and most other animals have a dopamine system. What this does is it rewards us for identifying patterns. The problem with poker machines is they give you a dopamine hit every 2 or 3 seconds. And in recent years, poker machines, being fully electronic now, are able to incorporate enormous numbers of dopamine hits by the way that they have been constructed.
Laurie Brown became addicted to those dopamine hits and lost $230,000. Does it still have an impact on her life?
Yes, it does, because that was set aside as retirement savings, and we had plans for that money. So, one, financially, it has had a major impact, so I'll have to continue working. In terms of relationship, it does immense damage because of the abuse of trust. So if you have an addiction to poker machine gambling, you tend to be incredibly secretive. You have great abilities of covering up and lying. So at home, my partner and I would be talking about buying another farm property, and I'd just talk about that, knowing full well that I'd spent most of the money we would have used for a deposit. And my story is not uncommon.
Unfortunately, it's not. And as time went by, Kate Seselja went down her own awful path.
Every time there was not enough money to do anything, I took on that load. I took on that, you know, it's my fault, it's my fault, you know, I'm wrecking everything. And it just was such a burden I just couldn't bear any longer. And until 2012, that's when I almost took my life.
It got as bad as that?
Yeah, it did.
As a mother of five?
I was pregnant with our sixth. That's why I didn't take my life.
Thank God.
I know. It was just, like, to be honest, so many of those years are an absolute blur. You know, when you're, what I now understand about how when you're in a highly emotional state and you're driven by toxic stress, you are not yourself. You are not an awake human being. You are going through the motions. You're existing in your life. And I didn't understand any of that. I was totally driven by shame, fear, and regret. And my life was out of control. It was a blur. And I was just trying to keep it together. And when I got to that point, I just had nothing left.
There is some good news. We're not losing like we used to.
Per capita inflation-adjusted gambling losses peaked somewhere between the year 2000 and the year 2008, depending on the state and territory you look at. And really, what's driving that is poker machine participation is falling. So I mentioned earlier that between 20 and 25% of the population gamble in pokies once per year. When losses were at their height, that number was more like 40%. So while losses are falling, we also know the number of people playing the pokies are falling. And once you look at those two things together, what you actually see is that while overall losses are falling, the amount of money that's lost by each individual person who's playing is actually increasing. So we have this strange paradox where fewer people are playing the pokies, but those who are still playing the pokies are losing more and more.
But what caused the reduction in overall losses?
It seems as though the biggest single intervention which has caused that decline was the introduction of smoking bans inside gambling venues. So somewhere between 2002 and 2010 in every state and territory, laws were introduced which meant you couldn't smoke inside poker machine venues anymore. And this has been the single thing which has significantly reduced the amount of spending on poker machines. And it's somewhat ironic that the best harm minimisation measure we've seen for pokies was not intended to deal with pokies. It was actually intended to deal with tobacco-related harm.
Actually, tobacco might provide a roadmap for what happens to the pokies. Most people regard them as dangerous and don't use them. For decades, it was the same with cigarettes, but the industry flourished. That all changed in the late 80s and early 90s.
What happened eventually to turn the tide was that the proof of the harmful nature and the addictive nature of nicotine and cigarettes generally was irrefutable by that point. And in the end, as I understand it, the tobacco industry collapsed in the richer countries and they settled with a bunch of the US states on a sort of a grand settlement, which disclosed the tobacco papers, millions and millions of internal documents, which acknowledged that they knew about the harmful nature of their product for many, many years before they admitted that that was the case. And of course, it cost them billions and billions of dollars. But I think the situation with gambling is not dissimilar. You know, the first case involving a federal court action against gambling industry corporations was held last year. It didn't succeed. It didn't get what it wanted, but it did highlight many of the characteristics of these devices and make many people, I think, more aware of what they were capable of doing and the harm they were already wreaking in Australia and indeed around the world. And I think it's a matter of time before we get more cases like this, better evidence and a consensus publicly and politically that we need to rein in the gambling industry and in particular the poker machine business.
The pokies have money and political clout. But like Charles Livingstone, Francis Markham thinks a change is on the way.
What we kind of see in other areas of public health is that you have long periods of gradual change where not much happens, where community groups are campaigning, where people have been harmed by a product are campaigning, and it's long grinding work. And then all of a sudden, a tipping point is reached and things change. And it's really hard to say from here where that tipping point is. It could be this year, it could be in a decade, but the momentum's certainly heading in that direction. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the Wile E. Coyote who's chasing Roadrunner, runs off a cliff and doesn't realise that he's run off a cliff until he looks down. And gambling reform might be a bit like that, that we might not realise that we've reached that tipping point until we're over the cliff, looking down and realising, hey, things have changed and there's no going back.
Kate Seselja didn't fall off the cliff. Now she runs the Hope Project to try to make sure that other people don't find themselves on the edge.
I create events and speak in workplaces, unis, you know, talk about my lived experience, invite others to share their lived experience so that we can have conversations that help people to connect with whether or not they're being sustainable in their life right now. It's not about, oh, put your hand up if you're already, you know, experiencing struggle. It's what are you not paying attention to in your day-to-day life that could eventually lead to struggle, that could eventually lead to, you know, you mindlessly using something to, you know, escape from what is actually going on. I help people to recognise that the presence of struggle is that there is a product, an environment or a person that is harming your well-being. And that's what we need to pay attention to and either self-correct or help seek effectively, but not just blindly, you know, keep going and keep coping and, you know, allow for more and more people to be taken advantage of by, as I said, industries and products and people that are intentionally exploiting vulnerabilities.
I can see clearly now the rain is gone.
Thanks to Kate Seselja, founder of the Hope Project. Also Francis Markham, who's a research fellow at the ANU, Charles Livingston from the School of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Monash University, and Natasha Shull, who's at NYU and author of Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. If this program's raised any issues for you, you can reach Lifeline on 13 11 14. 13 11 14. The money's produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Russell Stapleton. I'm Richard Adie.
All of the bad feelings have disappeared. Here is that rainbow I've been praying for. It's gonna be bright.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.